UK Wine Show, show number 117. Tim Finn from Nordic Vineyards on UV Live. On this week's show, we're talking with Tim Finn from Nordic Vineyards in Marlborough, New Zealand. Tim has been experimenting with increasing UV light on his grapes to change the sugar flavour balance. And in the spotlight, we look at the future of English vineyards.
And in the news, Hong Kong HQ for China's biggest wine retailer and why fine wines are not so cool.
G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 117 for the 8th of August 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Tim Finn from Nordic Vineyards in Marlborough, New Zealand. Tim's been experimenting with increasing UV light to his grapes, and the idea is to change the way the flavours and sugars balance out. This is part two look at UV light and wine, and last week we spoke with Mariella Melinari from Catena Zapata about the effects of altitude and UV light on the grapes. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. China's largest wine merchant, Jointech Fine Wines, is planning to relocate its headquarters to Hong Kong to benefit from the city's recent waiver of a 40% tax on wine and beer. Mainland China has a wine duty of almost 50%, and so an increasing number of mainland China wine investors are now buying their wines in Hong Kong. Jointech Fine Wines, who were established in 2000 to import internationally established brands to China, say Hong Kong's also better for transport and logistics. The company hopes to relocate as soon as possible and is currently trying to identify a good site. They also plan to open wine shops to add to the 50 shops they have in mainland China.
Great, Jane. What's next up?
Well, staying with fine wines, a study into storage conditions of fine wine has discovered that stores keep some fine wines at 22 degrees Celsius or higher. The study was carried out by Decanter magazine in stores in and around London that included Fortnum & Mason, Harvey Nichols, Marks & Spencer's and some branches of Tesco and Sainsbury's, as well as local stores. A few examples included Fortnum & Mason, who displayed a £230 Champagne Salon 1996 at 22 degrees, as well as Bordeaux and other fine wines. And at Marks & Spencer's Oxford Street branch, a bottle of Champagne registered 20 to 22 degrees and a £60 Burgundy at 22 degrees Celsius. Sainsbury's and Tesco also displayed fine wines at high temperatures at some of the stores that were visited. Sainsbury's issued a statement saying that their fine wines are fast-moving and are on shelf for no more than a couple of weeks on average. We should point out that Selfridges was found to have the coolest wines on display.
Well, with the rush to fine wines by many supermarkets and other multiples, this highlights the issues associated with storing fine wines. If a wine is to be purchased for immediate drinking, or maybe even drinking in a year or two, it's probably okay. The most important thing with temperature is not to change the temperature that much, so heating up and then cooling down repeatedly is by far and far the worst thing, rather than just having the temperature at the wrong temperature. But if you're planning on selling the wine later on, then storage is important. Also, if companies don't bother to store the wines in the correct temperature, I'd be a bit worried about how they're transporting the wines in the height of summer. Temperatures in a truck in the middle of summer could get very, very, very high and create a real cooking issue for the wines. If you're into high-end wines, I personally don't think you should be buying them at the supermarket. Do a Google search, find a good wine company, and buy them from them. Supermarkets are not interested in keeping fine wines fine, so talk to someone whose life is all about that, and I'm sure that's the best answer. What's the final news story this week, Jane?
Our last story this week is about a new film about wine, which is released on the 8th of August in America, following mixed reviews at its premiere at the Sundance Film Festival. It's called Bottle Shock, and it's the first long-awaited movie about the famous Judgment of Paris tasting, where Bordeaux wines were tasted blind against their Californian counterparts in 1976. Stephen Spurrier, who orchestrated the event, is played by Alan Rickman, and the film is directed by Randall Miller. That's all from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories from our website at 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I'm looking forward to Bottle Shock, but sadly, while it's on general release in the US now, they have no plans or release dates for the UK. We will, of course, keep you informed on when it will be released, and hopefully I'll be able to give you a review as well. How Bottle Shot will go in the UK in the future, it's hard to say. But on things that are going to do well in the future in England, English wine is one of them. And next up in the spotlight, we have a look at the future of English wine. So, the future. What grapes and styles can we expect over time? Many in the industry believe that the future of English wine is sparkling wine. The soils, chalk and limestone, are similar to Champagne, particularly in the south of England. The climate is similar and getting better. There is also an acceptance of non-vintage sparkling wines, which helps English winemakers maintain consistent standards in poor years. It's not surprising then that much of the 2006 new plantings were for sparkling wines, with Chardonnay and Pinot Noir now having a huge lead over other still wines. But two relatively new grape varieties for still wines are gaining favour, Bacchus for the whites and Rondo for the reds. According to vine importer Stuart Smith of the Vinehouse, Rondo is a very early ripening variety. It produces a ruby red wine and can also be used for blending. Unusually for wine grapes, it also has a reddish flesh. Bacchus is a white variety producing clean, crisp Sauvignon Blanc style white wines. Other varieties with their approximate market size are mainly German. Cool climate varieties such as Müller-Thurgau, 13% of plantings, Reichensteiner at 12%, Bacchus at 10%, and Schlumberger at 8%. The main non-German variety is a white French grape, Sauvignon Blanc, which has got 7% of plantings. Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are also planted. According to Owen Elias from Chapel Down and the English Winemaker of the Year in 05 and 06, Riesling is also worth experimenting with in England. England can also make some very good English rosés. This is due to the cool temperature and the long growing season. Red grape varieties are far less common. The last statistics I had was 677,000 bottles of red versus 2,690,000 bottles of white wines. That was based on the 2006 figures. With an increase in rosé throughout England, English winemakers have started producing some very good dry examples. In the future, global warming may be scaring many people, but English winemakers look like one of the groups that's going to benefit. Some scientists predict that by 2080, the south of England could be similar to Bordeaux. Already growers attempting to grow Bordeaux grapes, Cabernet Sauvignon in Gloucestershire, albeit in polytunnels, a bit like glasshouses, that are used to assist normal ripening of strawberries. But it is the scale of new plantings that are showing the industry confidence, with over 120 hectares planted in the southeast in 2006. And it's in York, in the north of England, that it's most surprising, with the number of vineyards increasing from 1 to 4 in 2006. The future of English wine has never looked brighter. Climate change, a core group of professional winemakers, and a burgeoning understanding of soils and varieties are all conspiring to create a young, energetic wine industry. That ends this week's look at the spotlight. Next week we cover Stephen Skelton's new book, UK Vineyards. We will do a book review in the spotlight as well as next week's interview with Stephen. But next up we have the interview with Tim Finn on UV light and the effects of wine. Let's have a listen to what Tim has to say. Hi, I'm here with Tim Finn from Norda Vineyards in Nelson, New Zealand. How are you, Tim?
I'm great, thanks.
Excellent. What we're going to be talking about today is green-lip mussels. Well, not quite green-lip mussels. You've been carrying out a wee experiment putting mussel shells on your vineyards. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yes, we have. Nelson, you may or may not know, is the sort of green-lip mussel shell capital of the world, or mussel capital of the world. We have lots of mussel farms there, and a huge byproduct from that industry, of course, is millions of mussel shells piled up and used for various things. Just a bit of background. Probably for the last 15 years and perhaps more, the fashion or the trend in wine has been towards riper flavours. Mm-hmm. And the public have liked it, and winemakers have liked it too, I guess. But to get riper flavours, basically that means, as with any fruit, you leave it on the vine longer. You leave it on the vine longer, of course, you tend to get higher sugar levels as well. So the downside has been getting higher alcohols in your wine.
Sugar converts to alcohol, so...
Absolutely, yeah. And to some extent, that can be balanced anyway. But, you know, it's nice not to get too high in the alcohol levels. The wines show different attributes, but also your ability to consume them, becomes limited.
Yep.
It's nice, for instance, to be able to have a glass of wine at lunchtime and then go back to work if that's what you want to do without it having any great effect on you,
sure.
apart from having a good time with it. So there are lots of people around the world who are looking at this, and you know, obviously there are ways around it. If we were looking at replanting at this stage, we'd probably be perhaps looking for clones that produce lower sugar, but sugar with ripe flavors. You know, you don't have to have high sugar levels to have ripe flavors. But of course, in the past, we've taken most of our clones of, say, Pinot Noir from France, and when they have sorted them out at that stage and gone through the process of saying which ones they like, they've actually given a big tick under that situation to the ones that produce good sugar,
mm-hmm.
Because in the past and under those situations, that was a good thing to do. You know, it was what they required. Now, with us leaving it on the vines longer, but also growing in newer places where we have different climatic conditions, we are ending up, as I say, with this problem. So, one of the ways we saw to look at cutting down this level of sugar at the time that we are having ripe flavors was to separate out the two ripening processes. And they are separate, the separation of the flavor characteristics versus the accumulation of sugar. There's two things going on, yeah. usually at the same time. But
they call it, phenolic ripeness versus sugar
yes,
ripeness?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And the phenolics and the flavonoids are going through their pathways and ripening up and giving you nice flavors and sweet flavors, you might say, even without the sugar. So we start to look at what causes the differences between these two different ripening things going on. And one of them, I think, in the New World, for instance, in New Zealand, we perhaps get our heat later in the summer than earlier. If you get the heat earlier, it starts the ripening of those compounds and they perhaps take longer to do their thing and get there compared to sugar, which just needs a good bit of sun and a whole lot of leaf towards the end,
yep.
To some extent. So what we looked at the possibility of preferentially getting more UV light onto the grapes themselves to see what effect that would have. And so to do that, we put mussel shells underneath the vines as a mulch. And what we did find was that it did in fact work. We could actually harvest earlier, or we could harvest at the same time and have riper flavors. Either way, the sugars remain the same and the flavors got riper.
So what was happening, though, with the shells? Was it the light reflecting off it? Or?
Yes, it's the light reflecting off it. There are, of course, a lot of things that are happening. It's a mulch. It retains moisture there. It puts it's a mulch of shells. It puts calcium into the ground and a few other trace elements as well, which is no bad thing. Keeps the weeds down, mm-hmm. So it requires less sprays or whatever under there. So it does all sorts of things. Also, the increased light on the bunches tends to make them slightly more prolific. You can get bigger crops on that just through initiation of the buds and that sort of thing. So it has a ripple effect. You cast the stone in and a whole lot of things happen. But
yep.
One of the things that happen is that you can preferentially ripen the tannins and phenolics in the grape.
Okay, the shells themselves, mussels I always thought were sort of a dark colour.
Well, they are a bit, but they do bleach in the sun. So if you leave them there long enough, they give us a nicely muted sort of a... It's, when you go through the trial block there, you feel as though you're on the beach. You know, it gets quite glary.
Yep.
So it really is, and certainly just reading the meters, it does. It gives you lots of UV reflected light there.
Okay, so the sun's coming along, it's hitting them. I presume the shells are crushed or broken up, are they?
Only accidentally, you might say. In the situation where we are, from the mussel factory, the shells get taken out and dumped in big blocks, and the seagulls go out over them over the year, and because there's a lot of smelly remains of mussel in there, you wouldn't want to dump them all on your vineyard. It'd be a fairly pongy sort of a place to be. So we get them when they're a year old. They've been sitting around, and then we come and put them on. So, you know, they've broken down a bit, and depending on the handling of them in the truck and moving through, they can get a bit broken down. But we like them to be as whole as they can be, really, rather than having, you know, mussel dust.
And do they start to decompose? Like you said, they broke down to put calcium back into the...
They will slowly decompose. They're holding up pretty well. We've had the trial going now for, well, various trials going for a total of about 5 or 6 years, I guess. And you have to initially top up, perhaps, you know, in the second year, because they spread out and whatever. But once you've done that first top-up, they seem to... of course, they're not on the track of the of the tractor at all. They're sitting directly under the vine. So as long as they're not getting sprayed out into the tractor lane, well, there's nothing to really do much to them.
Because I was going to ask about that, because muscle shells, I imagine if they're broken, they'd be quite sharp and almost a health hazard.
They could be, yes, yes. You wouldn't want to be dancing in naked feet there.
In the vineyards, yeah. Okay. So, trialled it now for 5 years?
We had an original trial going comparing muscle shells with Extende, which is a woven white matting that you can put under grapes or cherries or other horticultural produce to do the same thing. And we compared those with just bare land, as it were, or a bare strip underneath the, in between the mown grass, as it were. You have this bare strip under the vine. And compared those for about 3 years. We weren't really interested in putting the woven mat under our whole vineyard, but we just wanted to do the comparison.
Yep.
And then having found that there were some good, strong effects being shown, we then went into a commercial trial where we, you know, making real wine and real volumes. And from there, we've in fact gone into areas where we're no longer trialing. We're actually using them in a commercial sense under certain clones of Pinot Noir. What you're doing is, because Pinot Noir is such a diverse grouping of clonal types, some of them need this effect more than others. Yep. And we have a clone, for instance, called 10 Bar 5, which is an old Swiss clone in New Zealand. And it's notorious for, you really do have to ripen it up, otherwise you can get these sort of green tomato characters in it.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, if you do ripen it up, you run into these other problems as well. So it suits that sort of clone very well, of course.
Okay. Is it just you guys that are doing this, or have you said, look, this is what we're doing, it's fantastic. Here, why don't you try this?
We did it in conjunction with Lincoln University,
yeah.
And so we've been able to, from the sustainable production fund that the government runs, we've been able to have money to have students doing, you know, collecting the data and doing stuff there. We've sort of paid for the mussels to go on and what have you, but each year we have a student out there beavering away and measuring stuff and counting berries and all the good research work.
Yep.
And the final of 3 years of that particular experiment has just finished last year, and so it's finally been written up.
Okay, and do you think it's something that other vineyards may look at doing?
They could well do. There's certainly one or two over in Marlborough have been playing with it. Over there, of course, is probably... And on the Waimea Plains in Nelson, there is also value in just having a mulch that keeps moisture in, which is what it does. Because if you're in a situation of low moisture content in your soils, well, any mulch is a good mulch.
Yep.
Quite apart from the fact that you're doing this effect on ripening. So yes, it's a tool, and it's a tool that you can use in a lot of situations. Not everyone will bother. But
yep.
We found, for instance, at Brightwater in the Waimea Plains, where we grow a little bit of Pinot Noir of two clones, one of which was always a bit sort of greener tasting than the other, or we had to leave it on longer. We put shells underneath it last year as a result of this trial, and we managed to, in this last vintage, pick them at the same date with both of them looking very ripe.
Oh,
so
excellent.
That was good.
Yep. And so, but you're not sure of anybody at the moment who's looking to
do it in huge...
well, not in huge volumes, but no one else is taking it on just yet, or...?
Not that I know of. There are other various mulches doing it, but I think there are 5 or 6 vineyards around New Zealand that have been using mussel shells since we've
started. Excellent. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Brilliant. So it is starting to take hold as an
idea.
Yes,
yeah, there is a bit out there.
Fantastic. And you mentioned also about the mussel shells. They're a byproduct of the mussel industry.
Yes.
that they were being used for other things. Would they have normally gone in, out as a waste product of the mussel industry, or are they...
Yes, they are a waste product, and the mussel industry have been doing a certain amount of research on what to do with it. And, for instance, there is a certain amount of them are being crushed with other additives to make a fertiliser supplement because they are basically lime, as it were, calcium carbonate, which the soil types that we're on, we actually put lime on anyway because we have very low pH and not enough calcium in the soil, so it's a pretty good thing to be able to put mussel shells on. But it's probably cheaper to put lime on by the time you've carted mussel shells all over the place. But, yeah, there are these issues that people are... things that people are trying to do with mussel shells. I know some of it has been... for years, they've used them in drainage work. They sort of throw them down into the drainage pit, sort of...
they used to call them Māori drain, don't they?
They do. They don't anymore, though. And I think they've been using them in roading as well, you know... in some sort of concrete making process as well.
Okay.
Put them in there.
Just touching on Nordorf as a vineyard, you guys are in Nelson. Nelson's not a well-known region compared to, say, other regions in New Zealand. Do you want to just give us a quick overview of Nelson?
Sure. Nelson is, I guess, the sunniest area in New Zealand generally. It's a warm, sunny place. That's why all the immigrating British people go and live there.
Yeah.
But it's a very nice place to live. It's a place that's populated by a lot of artisans, a lot of potters, working artists. It's that sort of area. It's always been seen to be, in the past, you know, sort of a lot of communes and people seeking the good life there. And Golden Bay, of course, which is part of the Nelson province, yeah. Which is one of those no road out places. You know, you go over the hill and there's nowhere else to go. So they live in a time zone of their own.
It's Kaiteritiri?
Kaiteritiri is on our side of the hill, but yeah, it's just over the back there. But it's, you know, it's very much the Garden of Eden sort of place. But yeah, so Nelson's a nice place to live, and it's never too hot. It's cold in winter, but it's not bad.
Yeah.
And it has a burgeoning wine industry there, as you can imagine. We're only 2 hours away from Marlborough on similar climatic conditions, so we grow the same sorts of grapes there. We grow a lot of Sauvignon Blanc and Riesling, but certainly in the hills where we are, in the Moutry Hills, which are some ancient clay gravel hills, glacial-constructed hills, I guess, we really find Chardonnay and Pinot Noir to be our major wines there. You get the textural effects from these clay soils, which is really quite good.
Fantastic. Okay, then, Tim, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks for your time.
Okay.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Tim. In the interview, Tim said that he thought adding UV light through shells changed the ratio of sugar to flavours. This is a bit opposite to what Richard Smart said a couple of weeks ago, where he thought that the picking date was not that important. I've had a couple of emails from various people who think that Richard was a bit wrong about that, and I've been putting my thoughts together based on all the interviews I've done over the last couple of years, and I'm going to release that in the spotlight in about 2 weeks' time. But next week we're going to be talking with Stephen Skelton about his new book, UK Vineyard Guide, and a review of it in our spotlight. But next up we've got the quote, and this week it's by Alexander Fleming, the man who discovered penicillin. Penicillin cures, but wine makes people happy. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.